Hello again.
Hello.
We're right back at you with episode 20 of Marooned on Mars with Matt and Hillary. I'm Matt.
I'm Hillary.
And we're finally going to talk about Green Mars Part 7, What is to be Done?
In our listeners' experience, it may not seem that we have just been talking for a solid hour without actually getting to the chapter.
Right.
But in our experience...
We have been. Yes.
And then in the brief pause that we took...
We talked more. So we're talkers.
Yeah.
For better or for worse.
Welcome. It's good that we are talkers because...
This is the podcast.
That makes the podcast a good form for us.
This is the podcast where we talk about Kim Stanley Robinson's Mars trilogy part by part.
You read along. You listen to us talk. We read along. We listen to each other mostly.
Try to.
Yeah.
Do you know that there are people who listen to this without reading the books?
What?
It's true.
My sister has been, but she's read them before.
Yeah.
And she has an extremely good memory.
I have at least one friend who is listening and not reading the books.
Wow.
I mean,
that's a good friend.
She's great.
She's not just deeply bored.
Well, no, I'm not going to insult her by saying that she's deeply bored. She's very smart. I'm sure she's got lots of...
As she listens to these. Like, oh my God.
Why would she do that, then?
I don't know.
She's like some kind of masochist?
That's not what I'm saying.
She has a lot...
Stop putting words in my mouth.
She has a lot of options for things to do. She likes to go to the movies. She's a PhD student, maybe a PhD candidate even at the University of Chicago in the Cinema and Media Studies Department.
Yeah.
So... I would say that she's probably not using her time poorly, because that's not what graduate students do. Graduate students are diligent and hardworking.
I definitely didn't use my time poorly in graduate school.
No, me neither.
For a decade.
Only a decade?
No, actually, somewhat more than a decade.
All right, let's cut the shit, Hillary. Let's get to it.
All right, so...
All right, prologue of What is to be Done. I love this prologue, actually. Because it's a little bit cryptic. We're thrown into Sabishi through the eyes of these quote unquote visitors who we gradually come to understand in the course of this 3-page prologue are the first 100,
mm-hmm.
who for whatever reason do not seem to have spent a lot of time in Sabishi, even though they've been living on Mars for 40 years. And even if they have spent any time in Sabishi, they haven't really paid attention to it.
Well, they haven't been spending time there because they've been living in the underground, and they have not gone
right. And before that, they were
exposed themselves
underhill and burrows and stuff.
Right, right.
Doing their own thing.
Right.
But at any rate, they come upon Sabishi with fresh eyes, and look around and see how Sabishi is the Japanese colony which arrived on Mars 10 years after the first 100
mm-hmm.
did.
Mm-hmm.
And they look around and they, see it, and it's very different than any experience that they had when they, of their first 10 years on Mars, right? The community that they built.
The opening description, the few big buildings in Sabishi were faced with polished stone, picked for colors that were unusual on Mars, alabaster, jade, malachite, yellow jasper, turquoise, onyx, lapis lazuli. The smaller buildings were wooden. It's so crazily beautiful.
Very beautiful. And it also recalls Phobos, a little bit.
Yeah,
The community that Arcady built on Phobos is having color and being pleasant to look at and be around. And also the smaller buildings being wooden also does recall Zygote with its bamboo mm-hmm. structures,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
There are, it's on the equator, so there's really no difference between summer and winter, so they get plenty of sun all year round, which means that there are very lush gardens, trees, flowers, and a warm, breezy air.
Mm-hmm.
The Japanese who were there greeted their visitors as old and valued friends. They are dressed in copper jumpsuits. They're barefoot, long ponytails. many earrings and necklaces. All seems super chill.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And they meet Kenji. And I love this line. Yeah. This is just an amazing line. His name, one of them, bald with a wispy white beard and a deeply wrinkled face, took the visitors on a walk to stretch their legs after their long drives. His name was Kenji, and he had been the first Japanese to step on Mars, though no one remembered that anymore. I think that's just so beautiful.
It's great.
Because it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
Who cares?
Right. The individuals don't matter.
With that being said, there is a movie coming out in like October about called First Man, which is about Neil Armstrong. He's the guy, right?
Oh, I was going to say it's about Ryan Gosling.
It's definitely about Ryan Gosling. All movies are also documentaries. Don't be fooled.
First Man on the Moon, Ryan Gosling.
But it's going to be, I think it looks kind of cool. It's going to be an IMAX.
I mean, it'll either be cool or it'll be...
productively bad, so we can talk about it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, for sure. We'll definitely go see it.
It'll be for sure be bad, and we'll definitely talk about it.
Yeah.
So anyway, they're here, and they see Kami stones. They see these fantastic carved shapes that remind them of the Medusa fossae, however you pronounce it. And they all kind of, and we gradually come to realize that they're the first 100, and they all kind of say, why didn't we do this?
Yeah. It was easier for us, Kenji said. We were all Japanese together. We had a model. And somebody says, it doesn't seem much like the Japan I remember. No, but that isn't the true Japan.
Is that Hiroko, do you think? The Japan I remember?
It could be, yeah. It could be Iwao.
Yeah.
But a couple of them are Japanese, right? And it could be Coyote. I mean, he'd been to Japan, right?
Yeah.
Although that doesn't sound like a thing Coyote would say. And then Kenji, I guess, goes on to say, we're the true Japanese. What you see in Tokyo today is transnational. There is another Japan. We can never go back to that, of course. It was a feudal culture in any case and had features we cannot accept. But what we do here has roots in that culture. We're trying to find a new way, a way which rediscovers the old one or reinvents it for this new place. Kesai Nippon. Yes, but not for Mars, for Japan also, as a model for them, an example of what they can become. So here we have a kind of, it seems like a callback to the group we see a chapter ago, the Polynesian, who are doing Polynesian culture, and they're interested. Here we seem to be thinking about, they seem to be thinking about a different sort of moment in Japanese culture than the Polynesians are thinking about in Polynesian culture. But again, the idea that an interest in culture is not necessarily a regression, but instead it can be a way of making something new. And when you're saying we're trying to make Japan, you might actually be making something that is substantively different than historical Japan or actually existing Japan. But certainly we're getting a kind of evocation of things that... you know, to the Western, perhaps Orientalist eye, seem extremely, you know, beautiful and lovely about Japanese culture, you know, craft, attention to detail, et cetera, et cetera.
You're right. But this also, this concept of like, that's not Japan either. Like, this kind of thing of, you know, it's a very also American thing of like, Japan has yet to be invented. America has yet to be invented. And also it's a communist thing. You know, communism has yet to be invented. Clearly that thing that happened in the Soviet Union was not communism.
Or, and I mean, and here, what is, you know, what is it to be Japanese on this, or to be Japan on this conception that they have? Well, it's a kind of living experiment. That's what they're doing. They're building, they're making something, you know.
Constant state of becoming.
But we get, I mean, part of what gets set up here is this idea, it was easier for us, Kenji says, we're all Japanese together, we had a model. And that both makes us think about the ways in which the first 100 had to negotiate their various differences. But it also sets us up for thinking about what's going to come next, right? The difference between a small group of people who share a set of cultural assumptions, being able to build something together and find a way to live together, and a larger group of people who don't necessarily share cultural or political or economic assumptions? How do they live together? How do they feel engaged in something mutual?
Well, the concept of modeling too is super important here, right? That they had a model, like the Japanese of Sabishi had a model that was Japan, and now they are serving as a model for, or trying to serve as a model for Japan back on Earth, the same way that Mars and everyone on Mars has a model of what they think the good life is or was or could be based on things that have happened in the past.
Right.
They're trying to model their own, you know, current reality and future reality on those models of the past. And then also there is this potential, which we'll get to, especially when William Fort enters the picture, of Mars becoming a model for what the Earth could be as well.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
This constant state of building and being, or building and becoming, which is so easy to, especially today, I would say, like, lose track of the fact that, oh, you know, history has come to an end. You know, I mean, this the myth that history has come to an end, that there are no models anymore. Mm-hmm. We don't need to build anything anymore. We've achieved everything, and there are no options.
Mm-hmm.
There are no alternatives, right? Mm-hmm. Don't even bother imagining a better future, because this is as good as it's going to get, right? Here we have I correct me if I'm wrong, a, you know, supremely utopian vision of constant modeling and remaking. Mm-hmm. And what's the phrase, like, utopia is an endless meeting, never, right? Something like human utopia is just an endless meeting.
Yeah, I mean, here,
or democracy is an endless meeting.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things that is fundamental to this chapter, as it is to these books as a whole, and I think to Robinson just in his work generally, is a real insistence that however much we may be immersed in the conditions of our daily lives and feel oppressed, limited, maybe even harmed by them, however much that may be the condition that we live in, we are also still involved in making those lives.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And our ability to make our world, our ongoing making of our world, is something that we need to bring in front of us, to recognize, to think about, and then use. Because we're already cooperatively working together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To make, you know, the shitty version of things that we live in.
Right.
And thus, it is also for us to make the thing that would be better.
Right.
And that is painful and hard.
Yeah.
And probably not something that has a kind of clear end point. I mean, that idea of the model, we get the idea of the model and the experiment both raised in this chapter. And it's not clear. And I think that part of what we see is that neither one of those things is something stable, right?
Right.
You don't just have, like, this is a model for this, and then we have a relation
right.
that's sort of set in stone. Or this is an experiment and there's an end to the experiment. Rather, there's this kind of ongoingness
right.
that is, like, democratic living together is a process.
And what I mean, like, just going to the model thing again, like, taking something as a model for something else, when you start to examine that model, you start realizing that the model isn't the thing that you thought it was in
yes,
the first place,
yes, exactly.
right? And secondly, the kind of the making that has to happen that you were talking about, that we are already in the process of collaboratively, collectively making the shitty reality that we're in now, involves choices every single day that you choose to do or not do. Like
right.
you choose to go to work. You choose to be in graduate school, for one example, right? You could choose not to be in graduate school. You could choose not to finish your dissertation. The world will not come to an end. But it is very scary to make a choice like that and remake your life in that way. And I would just go back to the last sentence, the last word of the previous part, Tarikat, which is when Hiroka says, now we have to take the risk. This is a risky
mm-hmm.
endeavor that they're doing, even though what they're doing is just getting a bunch of people together in a room and meeting
right,
for a
right,
month.
Right. I mean, and just to be clear, this is not to say that people are responsible for the circumstances of their own oppression.
Obviously, blah, blah, yes.
Nor that it's the case that any one person acting on their own as an individual is able to make a substantive
right.
difference much as we make, hopefully.
Don't drop out of graduate school.
No, I think you should drop out of graduate school. I mean, unless you're enjoying it. And are you? But
what does enjoying it look like? What's a model that we could use?
I mean, this. So two things here. This, we're seeing a different version of a question that we talk about a lot in Red Mars, which is, do you think of Earth as an origin point? Is Earth the origin of Mars? Mm-hmm. Is it possible to make a break? Is it possible that history is not continuous? What does it mean to shed old histories to start again? Does that set you up for a repetition? What does it mean to live, in the wake of a set of, violent and unjust historical acts? Can you change things by cutting yourself off from them? Mm-hmm. Do you have to work with those things, right? I mean, and here we see those questions taken from the kind of idea of what does it mean to have landed on Mars, instead into the realm of what does it mean to be actually existing, already living, already making and doing and living together people on Mars.
Right.
So the question has moved from the realm, from what we might think of as a somewhat more theoretical question, into a deeply practical question.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's also like a matter of we're already doing it. So can we put words to this?
Yes.
Can we put it into something that we all agree upon and can point to and say, that is the thing that we're doing, some kind of, solid document to base our new Martian civilization on.
And, brilliantly and perfectly for those of us who care about a particular strain of literary theory, for example, we get the idea that how this is going to get set in motion is by the Swiss. And what the Swiss have is a sort of form in which things can be done, and the goal of the conference or the meeting or however we're going to describe this, the goal of this great convention of people is to begin to put some content into these empty forms that the Swiss have.
Right.
I mean, of course, form and content are not extricable from one another.
No.
in that kind of way. But we have this great vision of, well, what do you do? All of these people who have not talked to each other, who we already know some of the opposing positions.
Right.
And we know, because we know the history, we've been reading this, we know how much scarring is coming into this, as well as, opposing ideological positions, opposing worldviews. So we have the possibility here of beginning in this supposedly neutral way. The Swiss will give us a form.
Yeah.
And we'll start to have some meetings in which we begin to give content to that form.
Sweet. Yeah, the Swiss bring form without content, and they're all dressed in gray blazers or something.
Except the ladies who have dark green dresses.
Where is that? Okay, anyway. That's
on 357.
Okay. Oh, I was looking at the
page. So they
are
not wearing jumpsuits, and I don't know why the Swiss would not have just gotten over the whole suit thing and put on the jumpsuits, which sound really good.
Because they're Swiss. It's a non-jumpsuit culture. Everyone will tell you that. So yeah, they have all kinds of meetings or subject areas basically all planned, and then a kind of procedure for how they're to be gone about. Workshops are recorded, conclusions, recommendation. I'm on 358 now. Conclusions, recommendations, and questions from the workshops were to serve as the basis for a subsequent day's discussion at one of the two general ongoing meetings. One of these would focus roughly on the problems of achieving independence, the other on what came after, the means and ends meetings, as Art noted when he stopped briefly at Nadia's side. When they were done, I love this part. When the Swiss were done describing the program, they were ready to start. It had not occurred to them to have any ceremonial opening. Werner, speaking last, reminded people that the first workshops would begin in an hour, and that was that. they were done. I love this. I mean, that's why they're wearing gray suits.
Yes, yes.
Because they don't have the imagination to wear a jumpsuit and realize that they're living in a sci-fi right. future. And in a sci-fi future, you wear a freaking jumpsuit.
Well, they'd notice they would be a lot more comfortable if they were wearing something that does not constrict your waist.
Right, exactly.
I mean, right. And it's this kind of, so we have this sense here that procedure and form and having a formalization of how discussions are going to go on is incredibly important. Mm-hmm. And we kind of see that because otherwise, well, you know, everybody's just going to be yelling at each other. Mm-hmm. So we need some kind of container to put all this stuff in. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, all they have is this form and mm-hmm. they're kind of like, all right, let's hand it over.
Yeah.
But of course, you know, we know that this is a pretty inadequate way to begin mm-hmm. anything. Or mm-hmm. there's nothing that acknowledges the common project, right?
Yeah.
Other than a kind of empty form.
Yeah.
So in the presumably the silence that follows mm-hmm. after Werner reminds them that the workshops are going to begin in an hour, Hiroko walked slowly into the center of the circle. She wore a bamboo green jumper and no jewelry, a tall, slight figure, white-haired, unprepossessing, and yet every eye there was locked onto her. And when she lifted her hands, everyone seated got to their feet. In the silence that followed, Nadia's breath caught in her throat. We should stop right now. We should stop now, she thought. No meetings. This is it, right here. Our presence together, our shared reverence for this single person. Mm-hmm. We are the children of Earth, Hiroko said, loud enough for all to hear. And yet, here we stand, in a lava tunnel on the planet Mars. We should not forget how strange a fate that is. Life anywhere is an enigma and a precious miracle. But here we see even better its sacred power. Let's remember that now and make our work our worship. She spread her hands wide, and her closest associates walked humming into the center of the circle. Others followed suit until the space around the Swiss was full of a milling horde of friends, acquaintances, strangers. I mean, so Hiroko brings into this the sense of something shared. And for her, the shared thing is life, is livingness,
uh-huh.
is life itself. Mm-hmm. And the idea of that as in its surprisingness, in its preciousness, in its miraculousness, something sacred.
Inherently mysterious,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, in its that mystery.
There's like a mystery religion thing going on here. I like the fact, yeah, this is kind of a benediction, right?
Yeah,
it's kind of
yeah.
a saying like, let's remember why we're here and how crazy it is that we're here. And a
baseline, like here's a baseline. What are we doing here? Well, we all have something in common. We came from Earth, although of course, as it turns out, well, they didn't all
Not
come
all
from
of them
Earth,
did.
Right? But we came from Earth. We're alive.
Right.
There was nothing alive on this planet before we got here. The livingness itself is this thing that we have in common. So
right.
that's the place we're going to start.
Well, and like making our work our worship seems like an ideal thing, right? That that would be a utopian sort of goal of, you know, not having to do drudgery. But
right.
that your work would actually be a constant celebration.
Right, right. Suffused with mystery,
yeah.
transcendence, or at least suffused with the sense that you do it because you share something with other people.
Yeah.
Which I feel like most of our work does not involve us thinking,
oh, I was going to say,
because we share anything with anyone else.
I was going to say, that's why you're in graduate school, right? Okay. That beeping you heard was my coffee maker, if you heard it. So then they're into it. They get into the meeting. And now this chapter is told through the perspective of Nadia. And Nadia occupies a very fundamental, central position in this whole conference, although it's a weird kind of centrality because it's also on the periphery
mm-hmm.
and it's one that flits in and out of meetings constantly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So she, Art, and Nergal, not through any formal way, but just falling into it in a certain sense, become the organizers of this thing. Art is constantly serving people drinks.
He's always wheeling the drinks cart.
He and Nergal, who have become best friends, do a lot of work in terms of synthesizing the meetings.
They transcribe every session,
They transcribe
right?
every session and come up with a summary at the end of the day, which seems impossible, but
oh my God,
we'll let
so
that
exhausting.
Go. And Nadia sort of supervises them in a certain
right.
big sisterly, motherly kind of way. They ask her advice. She fills in the blanks or, you know, kind of makes, I guess you'd say makes final decisions, although it seems it's framed not as a kind of a power play at all, merely merely as practicality.
Yeah, I feel like what they're doing is much more a sort of facilitation yes. role. They're facilitating the process. But there is, I mean, just as in that moment with Hiroko, that Nadia thinks this is the person who right. holds us all together, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I feel like when we were just talking about that, we were talking about the idea there, or, right, conceptually what yeah. it is that she's doing, or, you know, this locus of shared feeling. But Nadia does think this person.
Yeah.
And there is a sort of dynamic throughout here of questions about how much do the particular persons
yeah.
matter. Although I think that Art Nergal, Nadia, they seem much more to be there in a kind of facilitation mode, mm-hmm. despite the fact that at least Nadia does intervene at points pointed ways.
They end up calling themselves or being called the Triumvirate.
Right.
Which has like Roman connotations. But also, I mean, like you could float the idea, like Hiroko is kind of a Pope figure, like a kind of a, like she's like in the center of this Martian church or something. Whereas like Nadia is more like, you know, the administrative, like let's actually get, she, you know, Hiroko's a queen in the certain kind of, in the kind of like symbolic sense. Whereas Nadia, I think she ends up being the prime minister or something like that. But that's basically, you know, she's there to make sure things work, which is appropriate for her since she's a builder, right?
Right.
She's a construction engineer. Yeah. And one of the first things that we're exposed to as readers is a meeting about the origin, the events of 2061, and what caused them. What were the engines that made, you know, certain things happen, and how to, I guess. Well, what had gone wrong and why?
Right, and it turns into an argument about whether there is a need or what the need is for something like revolutionary violence. Mm-hmm. So, in some ways, this is a conversation about a historical conversation about something that's happened like 50 years,
yeah.
right, before.
But as we know, like, there, you know, Sachs did this research on the history of 2061 and kind of realized no one had actually done an accurate, a really quality historical project
right.
on it.
Yeah.
And from the perspective of Earth, the Martian uprising was completely peripheral. And the whole concept would be, well, what if we put it at the center of our account of the Martian-Terran upheavals of 2061 and sort of reconfigured our vision of sort of human history and revolutionary history from the perspective of the Martian Revolution. And from that perspective, for Nadia, she's adamant that there can be no armed insurrection on Mars. It will simply not, a violent insurrection will not work. They are too vulnerable to Earth's military power.
Well, and it seems a couple of things emerge from this conversation. One is that even the people who were not born in 61 are deeply entangled
yeah.
in the question of what that history, that moment means. Mm-hmm. And they're entangled in it. I think this goes back to what you were saying about Sachs trying to produce his, like, you know, scientifically rigorous history or whatever. They're entangled in it not as a historical moment, but as something that is much more, much closer to hand, much more palpable than something we would describe as historical. Then the question that's being fought over is not a question about how should we evaluate what happened in 61, but what do we do now,
mm-hmm.
right? And the sort of debate, we have the Mars First people who I think this is almost the first we've heard of the Mars First people.
Yeah, I think it's the first time that term comes up,
and we learn more as the chapter goes on about them, but they take a hardline position. I mean, they think that this is a fight that has to be fought, mm-hmm. right? Or, you know, violent means are the only means that will separate from Earth. But everybody is still entangled in 61 in a variety of kinds of ways, and the things that it turns out that one of the core sticking points for this whole conference, which is the argument between terraforming and the Reds, the non-terraforming or leaving Mars alone position, that is also caught up in mm-hmm. this whole argument. Since part of the argument against resorting to violent means is that as long as they're living under domes or tents, they're incredibly vulnerable mm-hmm. to the kind of military attack that transnationals can launch. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if they move to, you know, trying to make the Earth, Mars's surface viable, they've taken on a rapid pro-terraforming right. position. So all of this stuff is just like completely entangled here.
Yeah, later on, I don't know when, and I don't want to jump too far ahead, but later on, Michel comes into the picture and they do a bunch of semantic rectangles, which basically only get more complicated once you add in the idea of terraforming or not terraforming. It's not that, because that's already there, but it's on 368, actually. There were all kind of disagreements and no obvious alignments to be found among them. One night, Michel Duval joined the three of them for a drink, and as Nadia described to him the problem, he got out his AI and began to make diagrams based on what he called the semantic rectangle. Using this schema, they made 100 different sketches of the various dichotomies, trying to find a mapping that would help them to understand what alignments and oppositions might exist among them. They made some interesting patterns, but it could not be said that any blinding insights jumped off the screen at them, although one particularly messy semantic rectangle seemed suggestive, at least to Michel. Violence and nonviolence, terraforming and anti-terraforming, formed the initial four corners, and in the secondary combination around this first rectangle, he had located Bogdanovists, Reds, Hiroko's Ariophany, and the Muslims, and other cultural conservatives. But what this combinatoire indicated in terms of action was not clear. So it's just extremely twisted and complex problem mm-hmm. of what to do.
And something that can't get represented, you know, in the semiotic squares that he makes is also that people's feelings are still bound up with 61 too. I mean, and even Nadia in that first meeting,
right.
She intervenes and makes her statement partly because she's thinking about an argument she had with Arkady.
Yes, right.
So the personal part of personal history mm-hmm. and the capital H history, these things are not easily separable yeah. from one another. And people are angry. People yeah. are angry about things. Mm-hmm. People are angry about Earth. They're angry about the way that they're treated by the transitional authority. They're angry about the transnationals. And they're also kind of angry about the idea that they're going to have to compromise the ways in which they have developed to live in order to live with other people.
Yeah. I mean, at one point, Coyote basically says, screw Earth, you know, like, let them fall apart. And there's the opposition to that is, no, we actually can't do that because Mars and Earth exist in a system together. And if the weaker they get, the more chaotic they get, the more in danger Mars becomes because Earth has this military dominance.
And we get this throughout this chapter, even though the Swiss have set up this way to have these meetings in which they divide things up by topic and people go to different groups to talk through different things. And then they all come back together and they talk through what they talked through. And then they, you know, even though they have this form, the issues from meeting to meeting keep repeating mm-hmm. so that the next meeting that we see at length, we get a repetition of the Anne Sachs debate, mm-hmm. Which also, again, turns into an argument about whether violence will be necessary mm-hmm. To free Mars, to allow Mars to allow them to build what they want to mm-hmm. build.
They have, I mean, before we, just really quickly before we get into that, there was that part in that original debate about, well, what if we could turn the troops away from the mm-hmm. entities that employ them, right? Because the troops on Mars, they only have loyalty to these transnational corporations because they get paid by them.
Right.
They don't have a shared common nationality or ethnicity. And this, again, speaks to my problem of a lack of a mass or popular culture that binds people together, the imagined community that Benedict Anderson talks about, mm-hmm, like mm-hmm. the people who are employed, like what makes an Arms Corps soldier loyal to Arms Corps other than being paid by Arms Corps? Like, is there a corporate culture in Arms Corps that, like, you know, team building exercises and like getaways, you know, that make you like loyal to your supervising commanding officer or whatever? So they have these,
they probably sit around at night and watch Michael Bay movies.
Probably. Yeah. And I couldn't help but think that, like, if only we had that problem today, like in, it's fortuitous that we're reading this right now. I was listening to Democracy Now! Last week. It's the anniversary of the Chicago uprising in 1968. Mm-hmm. And in that Vietnam moment, there was an enormous, you know, anti-war movement within the military itself, that people were deserting, burning draft cards, all of this stuff. And partly, the reason behind that was the draft, which we lack today. So that, if you were to try to turn, and we had that one case, did you see that guy who was at West Point, and then he, in his hat, he had like socialism will win. Like, he's like a Marxist. No. He's like a Marxist West Point cadet. He got kicked out of the Marines for being a Marxist. We just don't have that consciousness today. So that, like, the people who go into the military, they either go in because they get free college or because they're genuinely fascistic white nationalists.
Yeah.
Who, like, want to kill brown people.
Well, I mean, this is an interesting thing to think about in this chapter, because of course on the one hand, and we talked about before when Sax is being tortured,
right,
or even when Anne threatens him with being tortured, that part of what we have this spectacle of here is a moving of like the monopoly on force and on violence,
right,
from a state, mm-hmm, you know, which, and we tend to think of states as associated with nations, right, from a state into the hands of a corporation.
Yeah.
And when we talked a bit about mercenaries on Mars,
yeah,
and here we see a kind of push pull with that. Cause on the one hand, there isn't a kind of ideological dimension, or at least that's what they're sort of speculating. We actually don't meet any of these soldiers, so,
right,
you know, who knows? Mm-hmm. On the one hand, there's not an ideological dimension. They're just being paid, right? Right? So maybe that opens up the possibility that they would be willing to leave.
Right.
On the other hand, like, it may be the case, you know, so maybe there's something that's, like, useful or profitable there. On the other hand, you know, if you think that, like, part of what we see in these books is that it turns out that, like, the restless forward momentum and ceaseless reinventing of itself of capital turns out actually to be like more long-term sustainable and effective than the nation state,
right,
then we might actually think, well, it's even harder to break apart you know, the mercenary army,
yeah,
than the army that has you know, fights for nation,
right.
Yeah.
But you would think that if the mercenaries on Mars could be awakened to their common Martianness,
mm-hmm,
right, that seems to be the area where Nadia is placing her bet, right, that they probably don't have any loyalty to the people in charge of them other than the fact that they get paid, and if we can replace them getting paid with a feeling of Martianness or belonging or some other, or just pay them a different way, then it ought not to be that difficult to turn them to our side and effectively decapitate, or what does Art say, forcibly disemploy or something? Provide retirement benefits.
Right. But then I think that then opens up one of the big questions here, that is, and which is not answered in this chapter, but is, you know, asked again and again, which is, what does it or would it mean to awaken,
right,
a Martian-ness?
Right.
If we don't think of that as something on an analogy with nationalism, mm-hmm, which surely that is not, could not be what this utopian political project could be. Oh, right. let's produce a version of like believing in Mars in the way that we believe in, you know, the nation.
Right.
I mean, that doesn't sound good.
No, it hasn't worked out, you know, so far.
it's actually worked out quite, you know, to the great detriment of many, many people.
Yeah.
You know, so what does that mean, right? And not only if we don't want it to be analogous to national feeling or something like that, we also probably don't want the feeling of being Martian to be analogous to like a sort of an internationalism. I mean, mm-hmm. there are no nations on Mars. What could that mean?
Right, right.
So what is this? What is this sense of right. being Martian? And yeah.
this is the problem that they're yeah, faced with.
Right. So we can have that image of Hiroko there saying it's our livingness. Mm-hmm. And it is, you know, you know, moving and powerful as that is as a sort of ceremonial moment, does that give us something like a sustainable mm-hmm. way of thinking about what is shared?
Mm-hmm.
Or how do we convince people that that is a sustainable way right. of thinking about what's shared? So all of those problems seem like deeply tangled up, not to mention that, of course, every one of those problems comes back to the terraforming
right.
debate.
Right.
Because your idea about what it is to be Martian
yeah.
surely has something to do with your idea about what that planet itself
yeah.
is.
Yeah, it's that maybe abuts to another point that I wanted to make about this section here. And I know we've only... But where they're comparing it to other revolutions, right? And Nadia at the bottom of 359, she goes, it's inherent in the method. If you choose violence, then you create enemies who will resist you forever. And ruthless men become your revolutionary leaders. So when the war is over, they're in power and likely to be as bad as what they replaced. Not in American, Sex said. I don't know about that, replies Nadia. And just in the margin, I have like, you know, not for the slaves,
yeah.
not for the Native Americans, right? The American Revolution was like one kind of whatever uprising. If our friend Tristan was here, he would say it wasn't a revolution at all. But like, yeah, there is this still the and in Mars, it's that it's there's an analogy there to that red green problem with that red green problem of, you know, even a distinct break from Earth will not alleviate the problem of terraforming there.
Right.
And what they
yes.
what
yes.
the conception of a native Mars is
yes.
or what Mars is.
Yeah. And the sort of when I was reading that section, I was thinking about the Haitian Revolution.
Right.
Which is a revolution and is a moment in which you know, what comes after is not a repetition of what came before because it breaks it breaks the colonial mm-hmm. chains, mm-hmm. right? Which is kind of interesting to think about the sort of yeah, I mean, whatever, I can't do this any kind of justice, but it would be interesting to think about that because of the way in which the Haitian Revolution takes the French Revolution
right.
and takes the yeah. terms of the Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen incredibly seriously,
yeah.
right? Seriously enough to be able to show, you know, what we might think of as the sort of hidden flaw in
yes,
that declaration.
Right. Internal contradiction even within that
indeed, the contradiction. But you know, so it does seem to be the case that part of what's happening here in Nadia's perspective, I mean, she can sort of cite certain kinds of precedents, but really I don't think it's at all so clear that like a revolution does nothing.
Right.
But what is clear is that this is a moment where they have to wrestle with their own revolutionary history. And it's not totally clear that mobilizing, that trying to figure out how to use violence against what does seem to be the violent oppression that's mm-hmm. being issued at them, is going to do something that substantively moves them forward.
Right, right. And then we get into the new Sachs-Russell debate, or Russell-Claiborne debate, which I think is just so well observed and described by Robinson. With the knowledge that they're so much older now and they are sort of, they have changed a lot, but they're also so much more embedded in their ways.
Mm-hmm.
Sachs is listening a lot more to Anne than he ever has in the past, but Anne is also a little bit, you know, feels like basically pessimistic. Like the game is already, the jig is already up for her. The game is already lost in a certain way. So the mood I get from Anne is one of much, it's kind of more of an academic. She feels obligated to pose these objections, even though she already feels like they're kind of futile in a certain sense.
And Nadia observes, I mean, I think this is not the only place where she observes this, but she observes that an effect of their aging, mm-hmm. their great age, which she thinks of at some point as like non-human,
yeah.
they've lived past what it is to be a human being, has turned both Anne and Sax, she thinks of them as disinterested.
Yes.
And there's
that's
something,
what I meant by academic, I yeah, guess. Yeah,
no. But I think that that's, I think that that's interesting because it both suggests the possibility of, you know, we think, I mean, in the liberal political tradition, you're supposed to want to be able to be disinterested and therefore mm-hmm. to talk dispassionately and weigh both sides of right. an argument equally,
right.
you know, and from there, come to a reasonable conclusion. You know, at least that's the kind of 19th century liberalism thing. But like Nadia worries about the way in which something is, you know, they're having the fight. I mean, here we have another kind
yeah.
of form content
yeah,
problem,
yeah, yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they're having the fight, but what...
It's the form of a fight, but the content, or at least the content's not fiery enough, or I guess,
there's
right?
Some...
Here it is right there. It says on 363... there they were, standing in the center of the crowd. Anne had already lost this argument in the world itself, right? This is her reservation.
That's
this
so
is like,
painful.
Why
yeah.
have it? But like, yeah. you have to have the fight. As Coyote says somewhere else, we have to argue this. We have to argue everything. Her manner seemed to reflect this. She was subdued, disinterested, almost uninterested.
Mm-hmm.
The fiery Anne of the famous debates was nowhere to be seen. When the surface is viable, she said, when, Nadia noted, not if. They'll be here by the billions, right? The size it needs to be if you want a successful revolution. You could do it today if you wanted. Our shelters are hidden, theirs aren't. Break theirs open, they have no one to shoot back at. They die, you take over. Terraforming just takes away that leverage. And then Nadia refuses to be a part of that, right? But there's these irreconcilable differences that they're trying to reconcile. Like, we want a bloodless revolution, but we also don't want to terraform Mars, but we also do want to terraform Mars in order to have a bloodless revolution.
And it may, for Anne, have turned into this state of disinterest, which is quite, in itself is quite an interesting way to describe, yeah. You know, because it cuts both ways. That both sounds good and troubling. I mean, for Anne, things may seem disinterested. The world may seem that it has, you know, the decision has been made, mm-hmm. as has happened so often in these books, the material circumstances aided and abetted by human agency have changed
mm-hmm.
In advance of anybody's ideas having quite caught up to them.
Mm-hmm.
The Reds remain a substantive political force
right.
here. So there's not, and then we also have the Mars First people. So it's actually, Anne may have, you know, sort of aged out of her ability and also, you know, been kind of traumatized and exhausted out of her ability to have that fight that she once had.
Yeah.
But the fight is still real.
Well, and she's still as intelligent as she ever was and sort of still committed to, you know, the process of debate, essentially, or scientific progress, which is debate, right? Like, you see the world one way, I see the world another way, and I am obligated by the fact that I see that the world another way to say that, you know, to speak up, even though part of what the way that I see the world, my analysis shows that the way I see the world is wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
Or
yeah,
has already
yeah,
been
yeah.
defeated,
yeah,
essentially.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, I feel like the comment that Nadia makes on 362, or she's just thinking this, she's looking at Anne and Sax standing there. And again, all of this is so much about repetition and difference,
yeah.
right? Repetition in another key,
mm-hmm.
When something seems to have repeated but is actually doing something. Where's the new going to come from?
Yeah.
Right, we're seeing how much residual is hanging around people.
Yeah,
and we're struggling over what the dominant sense or mood is. But we also have this question about where is Nu going to come from? Mm-hmm. She finds the sight of Anne and Sax standing there unsettling. Most of the people there had seen the famous videotape of Anne and Sax's argument in Underhill, and certainly the story was well known, just to go back to that whole Paul Bunyan thing we were talking about last time, mm-hmm. One of the great myths of the first hundred. A myth from a time when things had been simpler. I mean, we know that they weren't simple, but things had been simpler and distinct personalities could stand for clear-cut issues.
Right.
I mean, something that I think is quite interesting here is we are still with the first hundred, but again we're being forced to see that as long as we name the debate Anne versus Sax,
right.
we're not seeing the debate,
right.
because it's not theirs.
Right.
They don't stand in for the issues,
right.
And they never did. In truth, they never did.
Yeah,
right. But that's not the story that can be told. And this whole convention that needs to be told, mm-hmm. and this whole convention is both marked by the continuing like sticky presence of these big personalities who people want to use as shorthand right. for positions, and at the same time they're waning,
yeah.
or they're necessary waning, because we're actually talking about the many here.
Yeah.
We're not talking about representatives.
It's true, but then at the same time, the people, the other big group here, I mean, there's another way to divide up this group is by the first hundred and the people who have been born on Mars. And while Jackie is extremely forceful, or she is a force, maybe I'll put it this way. While she's a force, I don't know how forceful she is
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
in terms of the way that, you know, the terms of the debate that Anne and Sax are having do not seem to be the terms of the debate that Jackie is having. And in a way to me, she doesn't seem to gather, you know, sort of the stakes of the Anne Sax debate in a certain mm-hmm. sense. Like, she's really devoted to this idea of being the next John Boone, which kind of clouds her ability to argue her own point. I don't know what Jackie stands for, I guess, is what I'm kind of saying.
I think this sequence from 363 to 364, which ends with the sort of like fantastic moment of Anne just basically insulting Jackie.
Yeah.
Which again, the entanglement of the personal in all of this, right? It's not, you know, we shouldn't think that we have these arguments and they're free from our own personal histories or personal stories, because if they were, like, why would we be having these arguments? Mm-hmm. But we have this really interesting series of sort of complications. So the Anne Sax fight, we remember how that debate goes. And, you know, Anne suggests that actually, like, leaving the planet unterraformed gives the Martians more leverage. Mm-hmm. Nadia says, no, you know, this is not a position we can hold. Hiroko says, a nation founded in, this is on 363, a nation founded in genocide is not right. what we want. I mean, this is quite interesting given that America has been presented as an example of a successful revolution, and we get the idea of the Constitutional Convention in the United States as a successful negotiation of a problem of representation
right.
later, right? But Hiroko says a nation founded in genocide is not what we want, and we might also ask, isn't that almost always what a nation is, right? And shrug, do you want a bloodless revolution, but it's not possible? This is kind of an interesting moment for Anne here. This is a different version of like Anne's like realism coming right. out. And Hiroko says, it is a silk revolution, an aerogel revolution, an integral part of the aerophony. That is what I want. Okay, Anne said. No one could argue with Hiroko. It was impossible.
Right.
Although it does seem like people are constantly arguing
with her. Yeah, but you can't actually have an argument with her, because she'll just respond cryptically again, right?
Like, although, I mean, you know, that idea of the aerogel revolution.
Well, the aerophony is not a thing. I mean, it's a thing. It's an idea with no words.
Well,
you know?
Although again. There's a bit in between that I don't want to leave behind, but 365, when Jackie gets up and whoa,
oh.
knocking over the microphone. When Jackie gets up I just lost my place.
365.
We're still having this argument, right? Mm-hmm. And we've got the younger hotheads. This is one of the places we get this like generational thing. The younger Reds regarded terraforming as nothing more than a part of the imperial process. So that's interesting. Hiroko has said we don't want a nation founded in genocide, mm-hmm. but the Reds see the association between terraforming and imperialism,
right?
Okay, so there we see like the idea, the sort of a claim to like this is the exercise, an imperialist exercise of power is happening on both sides.
Right.
Anne was a moderate compared to them. They raged even at Hiroko in their fury. Mm-hmm. Don't call it aerioforming, one of them shouted at her, and Hiroko stared nonplussed at this tall young woman, a blonde Valkyrie, yikes, made nearly rabid by the use of the word. It's terraforming you mean, and terraforming you're doing it. Calling it aerioforming is a sickening lie. We terraform the planet, Jackie said to the woman, but the planet aerioforms us. And that's a lie, too. Anne stared grimly at Jackie. Your grandfather said that to me, she said, a long time ago, as you may know, but I'm still waiting to see what aerioforming is supposed to mean. It's happened to everyone born here, Jackie said confidently. How so? You were born on Mars. How are you different? Jackie glowered, like the rest of the natives, Mars is all I know, all I care about, et cetera, et cetera. Anne's like, I don't see how you're so different. You remind me of Maya. But here's the thing. I think Anne can't take seriously. I mean, Jackie's not able to say the thing here, but she is different.
Yeah.
Nergal is different, mm-hmm. right? That is, in that way, there is a content to the aerial formation, and that content is in these actually existing people who have been born on Mars. Who are physiologically
it's in
different.
Their, it's, yeah, if it's nowhere else, it's in their bodies, for sure.
Right.
But then at the same time, I would just argue that what Jackie says are just slogans from John Boone's AI.
Yes.
Like, and again, like there's no content behind, there is form, but there's no content there.
I agree with that.
Maybe there is content waiting to be filled into that form, but, and that Jackie has not formulated it yet, whether she's capable of actually formulating it or not.
I think it comes out because then Anne says, I don't see how you're so different. You remind me of Maya. And we know that this is the thing that nobody wants to say to Jackie because she and Maya hate each other. But you know, Anne, for all of her remove and her dispassion and all of these things, does actually turn this moment into essentially a family argument. You know, oh, you're just like your mother. So here we have this, or your grandmother.
Right.
Here we have this, like, or whatever she is. Here we have this, like, specter of, you know, of the repetition of a kind of inheritance, mm-hmm. right? Of familial repetition, right? Of generational, you know, of a kind of transgenerational, like, you're just like your mom, right?
Well, and by deploying it, she demonstrates that it's still true. Like, right? Like, if they were really aerioformed, that would not be even regarded as an insult in a certain way, right? Like you wouldn't be able to insult Jackie by comparing her to Maya if they had created a brand new society, because the insult relies upon past societal assumptions and dynamics between whatever mothers and daughters or grandmothers.
But I think that assumes that the what it is to be new would be to have no tie to the past. I mean, I guess part of what I think part of what I'm trying to say here is I think that there are substantive differences.
Right.
And so on the one hand, like the idea of area formation and that you know, balances out that produces this like solution to the problem of terraforming, that doesn't seem right to me.
Yeah.
But I think at the same time, and I agree that like Jackie doesn't seem to, you know, Jackie has like a, you know, some of the worst qualities of John Boone in that like being a good slogan maker and being a charismatic human as opposed to being somebody who can actually work with other people to make things different.
Yeah.
But at the same time, dismissing too quickly. I mean, in this same section of the chapter, Nadia has had the thought, we're not even human anymore.
Yeah.
We've lived so long,
right?
So there are things that are different, right? And that is like, And the question of what shape they'll ultimately take
yeah.
remains to be answered later.
Yes.
But for now, you know, we do see a desire, right, on the one hand to insist on, from like Anne's perspective, to insist on one kind of difference. Mars is not Earth. Mm-hmm. It must be allowed to be Mars. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, to dismiss another kind of difference, which is the children born on Mars, they're just human beings.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And you can that.
Just reduce them to like the known.
And that, I think, is, I mean, isn't this always like part of the argument about what it is to have a revolution or a revolutionary? I mean, one of the ways that you rein that in is always to be like, oh, you're just the same.
Just, you know, the same. Just and the same. Well, and it's always the difference between a generational conflict too. We can see that what's happening with the opinions about socialism among people younger than 34, right, in the Democratic Party, and people who are older than 34 in the Democratic Party. But you wanted to go. You want to go back to the Anne and Hiroko thing on 363?
Oh, I just
grab that before we.
No, you know.
Why not? It's so good. I was gonna say. In control of what? I think that's such a great point. So she says...
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You go ahead. Go ahead.
Oh, well, I was going to say, the other thing that comes up here that I think is super important, and I guess it's actually two things. That the terraforming debate is also a debate about violence, about newness, about continuity, about difference, about what a human being is, uh-huh. whether you can like create a stable claim to what a human is, mm-hmm. Right? And it is interesting to think that the anti-terraforming position is also anti the idea that humans can change or right. be substantively different. But Anne links terraforming directly to the question of population.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, part of the problem with what you want is your terraforming is what's going to allow them to send billions of people to Mars. Mm-hmm. And the next step from that she makes clear is that terraforming is also linked to the ongoing viability of capital.
Mm-hmm.
Because what happens when we terraform the planet, not only does it become the possible haven for the rich, you know, in this like Elon, you know, Elon Musk, but it also becomes the place where capital can keep generating value out of it. And thus, like, the anti-terraforming position then also becomes an anti-capital position, even though on the terraforming side, people are also anti-capital.
Right, yeah.
And the problem of population is raised here, mm-hmm. right? Is the difference of Mars going to be that it's smaller?
Yeah.
Right? Can it live up to the sort of, like, you know, ideas that people have for it only because it's small.
Mm-hmm.
If it becomes a refuge,
mm-hmm.
Or it becomes a dumping ground, or it becomes like a site of like, you know, a massive labor, you know, like a new version of right. a massive army of laborers, mm-hmm. Will it not be Mars anymore?
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, what I like about that is I think it's really interesting that what we've thought about the terraforming position prior to this moment has just become distinctly complicated and much muddier with positions that have seemed to be in opposition yeah. to it.
Yeah, right? for sure. So one of the next meetings that we get to, so it's been an hour.
That we've been here?
That we've been in this oh. episode, and we've read 5 pages, 10 pages.
We're doing great.
We're doing great. I think we'll go for a little while longer, and then we'll probably stop and record another episode. Let's do eco-economics really quick, because that's okay. the next meeting. And the dual system of the need and the gift, right? So they are... this next meeting is sort of... Maybe it's not led by, but it's dominated by, maybe, Vlad and Marina's eco-economics, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this concept of that there needs to be two systems working together if the gift economy is going to have any kind of say. And let's see, on 369. And also this is also as the kind of Art Nagal and Nadia triumvirate is kind of developing and coordinating things or facilitating things. Vlad and Marina sent over frequent reports from their workshop on finances, each report sharpening and expanding their evolving concept of eco-economics. It's very interesting, Nadia reported to Nergal and Art in their nightly gathering on the Knob patio. A lot of people are critiquing Vlad and Marina's original system, including the Swiss and the Bolognese. Is it Bolognese? Bolognese?
Yum.
Bolognese. I'm getting hungry. And they're basically coming around to the conclusion that the gift system that we first used in the undergrad is not sufficient by itself because it's too hard to keep balanced. There are problems of scarcity and hoarding. And when you start to get set standards, it's like compelling gifts from people, which is a contradiction. This is what Coyote always said and why he set up his barter network. So they're working toward a more rationalized system in which basic necessities are distributed in a regulated hydrogen peroxide economy, where things are priced by calculations of their caloric value. Then when you get past the necessities, the gift economy comes into play using a nitrogen standard. So there are two planes, the need and the gift, or what the Sufis in the workshop call the animal and the human, expressed by the different standards. Nergal says to himself, the green and the white. And the Sufis seem pleased by this, which Art takes as a good sign. So this is really interesting, right? This idea that we need to fundamentally rethink what economics looks like. And while probably all societies have something like what you could call a gift economy, I mean, we all exchange gifts, it's not formalized. Mm-hmm. Here they're trying to do the work of formalizing a gift economy without creating a gift economy that compels gift giving. Because if you compel gift giving, it's not a gift, right? It's simply another version of standard exchange, right? I like this idea that that there's one economy that's based on the needs, mm-hmm. on basic needs, like a kind of a universal basic income outgo situation. Mm-hmm. And then once those are surpassed, it becomes a gift economy. Mm-hmm. So that it creates a kind of a two separate economy, like an economy of needs and then an economy of sort of luxury or something, mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. Things that aren't outside, that are outside of the bonds of just pure living. Mm-hmm. I mean, the things that you just basically need to live, and then allowing individuals to make decisions on what they want and what they're willing to sort of give in exchange for them. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, I don't know enough about gift economics to speak intelligently about this.
Yeah, no, I think what you're saying seems to be the way in which, at least the way in which we get the sort of scheme laid out very simply here. I guess the thing that I was wondering is, why do they need so the hydrogen peroxide stand becomes money, right? Right? It becomes the medium that allows for exchange, yeah, to happen,
right?
But
why?
I guess my question is, why do they need that for basic needs? Since it seems like the principle here, I mean, and when we get to the sort of the draft declaration of rights, although they don't put it that way, but when we get to that point, one of the ideas in there is that everybody has a right to the necessities,
right,
of living, like food, shelter, et, mm-hmm. cetera, et cetera. So why have that pegged to a medium of exchange, right, rather than simply find a way to distribute according to those needs? I don't know if that's answered in here.
I don't think it really is, but also, I mean, partly...
Another way to put it is, like, because core to Marina and Vlad's system is a scientific way to calculate value, right? So, like, they're going to use, like, energy or, like, caloric value,
right? Right,
is how you determine value.
And, yeah.
So here, value not set by the cost of labor, but instead by the degree to which, at the level of energy, this particular good fulfills need.
Yeah, and I guess that's kind of what I was going to suggest as an answer to the question of, if hydrogen peroxide is the medium of exchange for necessities, but not for luxury goods, right? And hydrogen peroxide is the fuel that drives their engines and cars and everything, then hydrogen peroxide as a medium exchange, as the person who holds hydrogen peroxide, I need to make a decision whether I want to use it to hoard goods of necessity or do other things with it, like build my house or drive my car or something that.
So this is a way to do distribution according to need without needing to have a state as the central locus of distribution.
No central bank, basically, without a central bank, because I guess would the question be, I mean, could we think about this analogously to what if we traded gallons of gasoline for gallons of milk? I mean, like, is that what we're doing here?
No. Right.
But it's also because also part of their, the next page goes into this question of inheritance law, right? And like what you mentioned before we were recording, that Sachs has this notion that there's an inherent human feeling to pass something on to the next generation,
right?
That there needs to be inheritance law, so that hydrogen peroxide, if it is the thing that you exchange for need, for necessary goods, it would mitigate the desire to hoard hydrogen peroxide and pass it to the next generation, right? You wouldn't be able to, if you need to exchange it for goods and services that you need to survive, you wouldn't be able to amass it in a way that you could exert undue power over others.
Right. So that's a bottom of 370 after... what I think is a great zing about libertarianism. Yeah. Mikhail is like basically saying, why do we have to have a conversation about inheritance law? Mm-hmm. Which everybody knows that's incredibly important.
Super,
that's how you keep from having an aristocracy or the version of an aristocracy that we have now.
Right.
Coyote says, sure, why not? Coyote has been upholding the position, we've got to talk about everything. Sure, why not? This is critical stuff. I say there should be no inheritance at all, except for a few personal objects passed on, perhaps. But all the rest should go back to Mars. It's part of the gift, right? All the rest? Vlad inquired with interest. But what would that consist of exactly? No one will own any of the land, water, air, the infrastructure, the gene stock, the information pool. What's left to pass on? I mean, part of the question here is so much is owned in common. Mm-hmm. It still puzzles me why you need money. But anyway, Coyote shrugged, your house, your savings account? I mean, won't we have money? And won't people stockpile surpluses of it if they can? You have to come to the finance sessions, Marina said to Coyote. We are hoping, I love the sort of like, Vlad and Marina are just like, they love eco-economics so much. Right. They've been working on it for such a long time, and they're still so into it.
Right.
Anyway, you have to come to the finance sessions. We're hoping to base money on units of hydrogen peroxide and price things by energy values. But money will still exist, right? Yes, but we are considering reverse interest on savings accounts, for instance, so that if you don't put what you've earned back into use, it will be released in the atmosphere as nitrogen. I love also, this is like such a great... the whole idea of like the releasing it as nitrogen, this like play off all that solid melts into air,
yeah.
Right? What does capital do? Capital takes the material conditions of, our lives. That is the most material thing of all, labor, and turns it into an abstraction, i.e. melts it into the air.
Yeah.
Right. And here, you know, that, that is taken literally,
yeah.
But when it melts into the air, it becomes materialized as the nitrogen necessary for living.
Amazing.
So good. So if you don't put what you've earned back into use, it would be released to the atmosphere as nitrogen. You'd be surprised how hard it is to keep a positive personal balance in this system. So why do they need money?
So I mean,
just to like facilitate trade in a way that makes it coherent.
Yes, I think so. I was listening to another podcast earlier today, the Brunigs. Matt Brunig and Elizabeth Brunig are very smart people. Matt Brunig runs the People's Policy Project, I think, and Elizabeth Brunig is a op-ed contributor to the Washington Post. They were talking about this issue, something about... I forget.
He does like Medicare for All
stuff, Medicare for All stuff. Extremely smart. And they were talking about like basically socialism and I don't remember how they got on this topic, but he was talking about one of these early Soviet theorists who was arguing for that they still need, like, the Soviet Union still needed a money system for an exchange of goods, because although everything is supposed to be held in common, people aren't used to just being able to walk into a store and take as much bread as they want.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So they would begin to hoard bread, and in order to,
so it counters
that, that sort of, whether it's a natural human instinct or whether it's a instinct implanted in us by the capitalist system, there is this impulse to, if you open a store and say, take as much as you want, people will fill up their shopping carts with all of it. And mm-hmm. then other people will be left with nothing. So you still need a medium of exchange. You still need an artificial way to limit the amount of stuff of the basic necessities that people will take. Because if you don't, they'll just take way too much than they need. They're like, you know, rats or something.
And here again, instead of money being these weird symbol covered pieces of slightly
worthless
greasy
paper.
Yeah.
Filthy. Cocaine covered paper.
What? instead of that, we have what will serve as the medium of exchange is something that has its own use value.
Yes,
right? So then we have a kind of like collapse. We don't have a distinction then between use and exchange.
That's
value.
Really interesting.
I mean,
too.
That does seem to be part of what eco-economics.
Yeah, that's really interesting too. I hadn't thought about that. That, like, you know, money's use value is its exchange value. Whereas if there was a different use value or a parallel use value with that money, if money had a separate and potentially equal use value than simply exchange,
mm-hmm.
then it would be treated a lot differently.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool.
There we go. We figured
it
out.
Great. It's cool. And then I did want to point out, this is when Sachs makes his claim that there is a kind of a biological basis of culture, which he first calls the baby logical, biological basis of culture.
That.
I love that. So that there's this animal instinct to leave an inheritance behind. I like that that comes right after on the previous page in an argument between Zake and Ariadne. Zake says hierarchy is a natural fact, and Ariadne says, but we're not natural here. Mm-hmm. We're Martian, which is, I love that. I like Ariadne a lot. And again, I think this is another thing that keeps coming in as this sort of like nagging sort of form of newness that isn't accounted for by the evolutionary account, right?
I mean,
in some ways they're not natural.
No.
Not natural at all.
No. And which only like underscores the need to argue everything that Mikhail doesn't like so much, right? And I can't resist reading the dig against libertarians.
So good.
But Coyote, you know, says we have to argue everything. We have to argue all of it. Even if you want no state or a minimal state, then you still have to argue it point by point, especially since most minimalists want to keep exactly the economic and police system that keeps them privileged. That's libertarians for you, anarchists who want police protection from their slaves. No, if you want to make the minimum state case, you have to argue it from the ground up. And he's so right. It makes these Bogdanovist anarchists led by Mikhail look really lazy, basically.
Like, yeah.
They just want to lay around doing nothing, not arguing. And who can blame them, really?
It's so good. It's so good. I like that on 374, you know.
Oh, there's this great paragraph. Is that the, were you going to, anyway, go ahead.
Were you thinking of the.
The big middle paragraph.
There. The air was still warm.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that was what I was thinking of. Look at that. So Nadia's, she's sort of moved into this mode where she's forcing Nergal and Art to, you know, they keep falling asleep over their computers and she's sort of forcing them to actually go to bed. Mm-hmm. But of course she can't sleep. The air was still warm, the black skylight stuffed with stars. The length of the tunnel suddenly reminded her of one of the full rooms on the Ares, here vastly enlarged, but with the same aesthetics employed. Dimly lit pavilions, the dark furry clumps of little forests. A world-building game. But now there was a real world at stake. At first, the attendants of the Congress had been almost giddy with the enormous potential of it, and some, like Jackie and other natives, were young and irrepressible enough to feel that way still. But for a lot of the older representatives, the intractable problems were beginning to reveal themselves, like knobby bones under shrinking flesh. The remnant of the first 100, the old Japanese from Sabaishi, they sat around these days watching, thinking hard, with attitudes ranging from Maya's cynicism to Marina's anxious irritation. And then there was Coyote, down below her in the park, strolling tipsily out of the woods with a young woman holding him by the waist. Ah, love, he shouted down the long tunnel, throwing his arms wide. Could thou and I with fate conspire to grasp the sorry scheme of things entire, would we not shatter it to bits and then remold it nearer to the heart's desire? Indeed, Nadia thought, smiling, and went back to her room. It's a great, great passage. With the sort of like the economy with which you get this picture of what this place looks like, yeah. Which I just, yeah, I mean, I love that. And the sort of the sense of like the little lamps, the little lights, is so beautiful. But I love that Nadia thinks of what they started out as doing was a world building game.
Yeah.
And now a real world is at stake. Mm-hmm. We have like a repetition of the sort of question about area formation versus terraforming. Mm-hmm. Is that what it is to build a world, to make it so that human beings can live on it? But also, like, you know, often what science fiction is described as being primarily marked by is world building, mm-hmm. right? I mean, so here again, we have the imagination, and then, you know, there comes Coyote, the yeah. most mythical of all of these people, as usual, like tipsy and with somebody good looking, quoting the Ruby out of Omar Khayyam. I mean, just like, it's so good.
Oh, that's the Ruby what you said?
Yeah.
I didn't know what that was from.
Yes.
I like the part where, the economy of words here that gives you this whole sense of, that there are people, especially the young people, who see the enormous potential and are super excited about everything. And then the older people who are faced with those same intractable problems, like knobby bones under shrinking flesh, mm-hmm. right?
Another version of materiality.
Another
right?
version of materiality. And another, you know, callback to their inhumanness, that they've lived for yeah. so long,
yeah.
that their those cells and tissue are in completely uncharted territory here.
Yeah.
There's another great phrase on 373 about not wanting to throw the baby socialism out with the Stalinist bathwater, which I think we should all keep in mind in this day and age. Let's try to avoid socialism Stalinism if we can, shall we?
Oh, the kitties are licking each other.
Oh boy, the cats are licking each other on the couch. Then we get Charlotte, who is this constitutional scholar. This is that moment where she says that the American Constitutional Convention was kind of a model of right. working these things out.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
from a certain perspective, you know, sure, it worked sure. out for a lot of the people involved.
Yeah, we got the Senate.
Yeah, we got the Senate. Mm-hmm. Thank goodness.
Yeah,
and
that wasn't a terrible idea.
Yeah, and we got the 3/5 compromise. Remember that one?
Yeah.
What a great one.
Yeah.
At the bottom of 375, there's this thing about leaders, right? Which I think, again, goes to the kind of thread that we've been following through with the importance of culture here and the importance of ideology, right? Where it says, they went out ready to work, two sharp young men and one blunt old woman. That's Art Nergal and Nadia. It was strange, Nadia thought, to see who emerged as leaders in situations like these. It wasn't necessarily the most brilliant or well-informed, as Marina or Coyote would serve to show, though both qualities helped. And those two people were important. But the leaders were the ones people would listen to, the magnetic ones. And in a crowd of such powerful intellects and personalities, such magnetism was very rare, very elusive, very powerful. Mm. Right? So there is still the possibility of sort of a kind of demagoguery or just simple charismatic leadership that can sway an entire population, yeah. even though, you know, the facts don't bear out what they're, may not bear out what they're saying, right?
And this that takes us into the conversation that you talked a little bit about earlier about what we should, about the relationship to Earth again, right? New version of the relationship to Earth. The problem of sort of the umbilical cord has been changed here to this problem about like the way in which these planets exist in a system. As long as they're in chaos, Earth that is, we're in danger, Nadia mm-hmm. said. We have to do what we can to help, to exert influence in the direction we want them to go. Someone else said, the two planets are one system. What do you mean by that? Coyote demanded. They're different worlds. They could certainly be two systems. Information exchange. Maya said, we exist for Earth as a model or experiment, a thought experiment for humanity to learn from. This takes us back to Nadia thinking about a world-building right. game, right? A real experiment, Nadia said. This is no longer a game. I mean, a thought experiment probably is a real experiment in some ways, too. This is no longer a game. We can't afford to take attractively pure theoretical positions. Always at the heart of political debate, and yeah. maybe particularly left political yeah. debate. She was looking at Kasai and Harmakis?
I don't think we've seen that name before.
It's a really nice looking name. And their comrades, as she said this, but it made no impact, she could see, because of course she's just saying it.
Right.
I mean, and that's another thing, I think the kind of, you know, there's a way in this chapter, as if we think about the chapter as partly a struggle, a debate among a lot of different positions that we could describe them all as left positions mm-hmm. in one way or another.
Yeah.
You know, there is a way in which 61 here can stand in for 68
yeah.
or 1917 or 1848. Yeah. So we have this sort of, there is a kind of echo here of the question of how do you move forward from either failure or dissatisfaction or incompletion.
Right.
But I think this moment, you know, they are thinking about Earth differently here.
Yeah.
And rather than, and the stuff about the model, the world building, the experiment, the thought experiment, I think all of that is fascinating. But also we have a different version of the question of how are we on Mars attached to Earth? And
right.
here, suddenly Earth might be the place that needs Mars.
Yeah.
Needs Mars as example.
Yeah.
You know, needs Mars as the avant-garde that it will follow, right? Yeah.
It's interesting to think, and I have this note basically in my notes where, to what extent do the fictional 2061 uprisings continue from or depart from the global moment of 1968? So to think, to try to, which people are still, obviously it's the 50th anniversary of 68, all year long.
How does that happen?
But it's interesting to think about that relationship between Mars and Earth and all the different countries on Earth in 1968 that were going through massive upheavals and all through those later 60s and early 70s of not only in France, the rest of Europe and America, but decolonization right. In the Third World, in Africa, in Latin America, Cuba, all that stuff, and where the models were being drawn from, and how mm-hmm. the global left was adapting to things that had happened in one country and trying to apply them in another country and stuff like that.
Right. Yeah. It's fascinating. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a super rich part of this.
Yeah. And it's very much sort of understood and undergirding what's going on here, especially in the moment of its writing in the late 90s or the mid 90s when, you know, we've had a major collapse of the Soviet Union, right?
And history has supposedly thus come to an end.
But then we also have, at the same time that we have the evolution of human political systems, we have this, Nadia goes on this sort of imaginative voyage of the evolution of life itself as she sees, as she comes across this. Is this when she's come across the kind of pool?
She's out, I think she's seen it before, but she's out walking again. And we have this really beautiful image.
Yeah.
Underwater lights at one end of the pond turned its water into a strange, sparkling, dark crystal. She could see a group of people splashing about in it, their bodies gleaming in the lit water, disappearing into the dark. Amphibious creatures, salamanders. And she's thought about this before when she's building, decides that they need a swimming pool and a sauna or a hot tub in Underhill. Once, very long ago on Earth, there had been water animals that had crawled up gasping onto the shore. They must have had some pretty serious policy debates, Nadia thought sleepily, down in that ocean. To emerge or not to emerge? How to emerge? When to emerge? Sound of distant laughter, the stars packing the jagged skylights. She turned and walked down a staircase to the tunnel floor, then back to Zakros on the paths and street grass, following the canal. Thinking in scattered, dirting images, back at their suite, she lay on her bed and fell asleep instantly, dreaming at dawn of dolphins swimming through the air, which partly, I think sometimes when we do that sort of, like, the Sachs's reference to baby logic, biological inheritance, we think that argument, that idea that about, you know, us as an evolved species that retains some, you know, prior version of ourselves. I think the way that you usually think about that is as like a kind of human continuity, a sort of, this is what it has been to be human. Mm-hmm. You know, we sit around the fire and tell stories, mm-hmm. or we want to leave inheritances to our babies right. or whatever it is. But I love that the chapter ends with this moment of thinking that maybe, you know, the long thing or the continuity or the place of something like the natural in us is not human at all, mm-hmm. but like this undefined kind of creature that crawled out of the water, mm-hmm. right? Or even that, you know, what happens at the end when she dreams, this is one of the dreams in here where somebody's not revisiting a moment of their childhood,
right.
but is dolphins in the air, right?
Yeah.
You know, which... yeah, I mean, the sort of, so we have this kind of this playfulness there, which is very Nadia. Mm-hmm. I mean, she has her, for all of her seriousness, she has her playful mm-hmm. moments, but which also refigures again how we're supposed to think about what it is to be a human making these decisions, having these arguments.
Well, the dolphins in the air too looks forward to next episode when we'll discuss William Fort.
William Fort
is going to show up at the meeting and help invent a new X game in the ponds in the lava tubes
of
Mars.
Yes, exactly.
But yeah, they were very much resembled dolphins flying through the air. So she's prefiguring that already. So let's wrap up this episode. Thank you for listening.
Yes, thank you.
You should, you know, follow us on Twitter.
Twitter.
Rate and review us on iTunes. Send us voicemails on anchor.fm on the app, which is free and doesn't pay us. And we're not being paid to plug it. And thank you for listening.
Yeah, thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye.